You know, it's interesting that Pete chose the topic that he talked about with walking with God, because today I'll be talking about some who acted like they were walking with God, but really they weren't. You know, when you read the gospel accounts of the life of Christ and what he went through during his life, you know, you can see that he wasn't really impressed by the leadership of his day. He wasn't very complimentary at all. And he called them out about their actions and their hypocrisy. And when you study through those scriptures, you get some really interesting insights about the things that he was dealing with when he was alive. You know, Christ used the scribes and the Pharisees an awful lot as bad examples. And we'll see as we go through, he had a very good reason. You know, we still have some of those attitudes and characteristics today with us. So this isn't just an ancient story. We need to be on guard as well. Today, what I want to do is I want to take a look at the eight woes that Christ mentioned. He leveled those eight woes on the scribes and the Pharisees. And I'd like to give a little bit of history of what he was talking about and what he said. Now, it's interesting when you first start about looking into this topic and studying this topic, a lot of the commentaries out there contrast Matthew 5, the Beatitudes, or the beautiful attitudes, with these eight woes. They're opposite in tendencies. You know those Beatitudes very well. They're found in Matthew 5, and we don't have to turn there. But blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And so forth. There are nine of those, nine principles that Christ teaches his followers, and that we should understand that we should pick up those characteristics and those tendencies. They're the proper behavior, the proper attitudes. And he makes his point a number of times when giving the Beatitudes. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven, for they shall be comforted, for they shall inherit the earth. They have a reward for those attitudes and for those actions. But in contrast, when you look through the eight woes, there's nothing but condemnation about those attitudes and those actions. That is a way of life that leads to death, eternal death. The woes are mentioned in Mark 12 and Luke 20 as well, but Matthew covers them in great detail. If you look into Mark 12 and Luke 20, they're mentioned just in a few verses, very quickly. It's just a very quick summary. But Matthew covers them very, very well. But before we turn to Matthew 23, let's get a little background of what was going on here. Because the story actually begins in Matthew 21, a few chapters back. So turn over to Matthew 21 and we'll start there. Matthew 21, and we see in verse 23 that Jesus goes in, he enters the temple, and he begins teaching. And we see right away, and I'm not going to read all this, you can follow along as I paraphrase what's going on here, but you see that the leaders, they didn't appreciate that very much. Not at all. You know, the chief priests, the scribes, the Pharisees, they didn't recognize Jesus as anything special at all. As a matter of fact, they denigrated him. They called him a bastard without a father. They called his mother a harlot, because who can have a kid without a father? That's obviously a made-up story. That's what they said. That's what they taught. And so you see in the story here, how dare he come in to the temple and pretend that he can teach us anything? That's what they say. Who gives you the authority? And like he did so many times, he answers their question with another question. Now, before we continue, hold your place right there, because we're going to come right back there and turn over to Matthew 24. Just a few chapters over, Matthew 24, verse 1 says, "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to show him the buildings of the temple." So everything between Matthew 21, verse 23, when he first entered the temple, all the way to Matthew 24, verse 1, is the same time period, the same day. You know, sometimes when we break into the story and we read these things, we don't understand. This was the same day and the same time. He went into the temple in Matthew 21, verse 23, and he left the first verse of 24. And he said all of these things at the same time. And it's interesting as we go through the story, they all listened to what he was saying. The scribes and the Pharisees, the Herodians were there. They were all there, the Sadducees, his disciples. So let's take a look at what happened that day as a little background. Back to Matthew 21. And I'm not going to read verse for verse all the way through. I'll read a few verses here and there. And I'll be using different translations, and hopefully I'll tell you which one I'm in, so you can keep up, but you don't have all these translations, so just do the best you can with it. Verse 23, this is from the New Living Translation. Let's start there. And we already talked a little bit about this. The leading priests and elders came up to him, and they demanded, "By what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you the right?" "I'll tell you by what authority I do these things if you answer one question," Jesus replied. "Did John's authority to baptize come from heaven, or was it merely human?" So Christ answers their question with a question of his own. Like he did a lot. He did that an awful lot. So he says, "What do you think about John?" You know, as you read along, you see that they huddle up a little bit and they're trying to think, how should we answer this? You know, you can see the wheels turning in their head. Well, we can't say this, but we can't say that. So they finally decide that they're not going to answer. So they say, "Well, we can't tell if John was of God." Well, was their answer true? You see right there in the story, that's not true. That's not true at all. They didn't have any respect for John either, but they feared the people. And you see that. So in verse 27, they finally replied, "Well, we don't know." This is still New Living Translation. And Jesus responded, "Well, then I won't tell you by what authority I do these things." So he didn't answer their question. Then Christ goes into a few parables. He insults them. And he concludes in verse 31 of the parable of the two sons. He goes through that parable. And in verse 31, he says, "Now, which one did the will of the Father?" And they said, "Well, the first." And Jesus said, "Well, surely, I say to you, the tax collectors and harlots will enter the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But tax collectors and harlots believed him. And when you saw it, you did not afterwards relent and believe him." So that's kind of interesting. Then he goes into another parable in verses 33 to 44. This one's the parable of the landowner. And when he finished that parable, that angered him so much that in verse 45 we read, "Now, when the chief priests and Pharisees heard his parable, they perceived that he was speaking of them." Wow, how dense can you be? That was really wise of them to perceive that he was talking about them. And they really got upset about it because verse 46 we read, "And when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitudes because they took him for a prophet." So they really couldn't do anything about it. They were afraid of the people. Or they would have snatched him up right there and harmed him. We see another parable aimed at the Pharisees in chapter 22. And this was the parable of the marriage feast. And when he was done with that parable, they weren't happy at all again. So look what happens in verse 15 and 16. And if you understand the background of these divisions of folks that were running things, it's amazing that the Pharisees and the Herodians teamed up for anything because they really hated each other. They didn't like each other at all. But they try to trip up Jesus with another question. And in verse 22, it tells us, "When they heard his answer," when they heard these words, "they marveled and they went their way." Where'd they go? They probably went to huddle up and talk about what we can do next. But we see later in the story that it was the Sadducees' turn to question him. So in verse 23, "The same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him and asked," and they asked him a question that you can read there. So they take their crack, their shot at tripping up Jesus. But he said in verse 29, "You're mistaken, not knowing the scriptures or the power of God." But that wasn't the end of the story. Still, the Pharisees and the Sadducees teamed up. In verse 34 and 35, they ask him another question. It's interesting that verse 35 calls this person a lawyer. A lawyer asks a question, it says. He was probably a scribe, as you'll see later on, because scribes were the law, the lawyers of the day. But it's also interesting, if you read this verse completely, they were all gathered together to hear his answer, as it says. And then Jesus asks a question of his own that shuts them up once and for all. "What do you think of me? Who am I? Whose son am I?" And verse 46 concludes the questioning with a statement that says, "And no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day on, or anyone dare question him anymore." So it's in that setting. It's an interesting piece of background that all happened as he was in the temple teaching. So after that, the Bible tells us that he turns to the crowd and addresses them. And he gave these eight woes that are listed here. It's also noteworthy to see, it doesn't say the scribes and the Pharisees, the Herodians, the Sadducees left. They were probably all there with his followers listening to what he said. So who are the players? Who are these four groups? I'll just give you a little brief synopsis because you could do a sermon on each one of these and probably still not cover it. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but according to The Life and Times of Jesus by Edersham, The Talmud says there were seven varieties of Pharisees in the day of Christ. And they all had some attributes, some strange little quirks. But the point is, they had supreme influence over the people of the day. They held most of the seats in the Sanhedrin. They had most of them, and they were widely respected and considered the common man's leader. So those are the Pharisees. On the other hand, the Sadducees were upper class. They were upper class. The International Bible Encyclopedia says this: the Sadducees was a prominent Jewish sect, though not as numerous as their opponents, the Pharisees. By their wealth and priestly descent, many of them had an influence which fully balanced that of the more popular rivals, the Pharisees. It's kind of interesting. It almost seems like Republicans and Democrats, 50-50. But they had more seats. But the Sadducees had a little bit more influence, seems like, that balanced things out. And, you know, we know from reading the scriptures, I just read one, the Sadducees who do not believe in a resurrection, well, the Pharisees did, you know. So they had their differences in doctrine. So what about the scribes? We talked about the scribes a little bit. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says, the scribes, and not the priests, were now the zealous defenders of the law. And hence, they were the true teachers of the people. At the time of Christ, this distinction was complete. The scribes formed a solid profession which held undisputed sway over the thought of the people. Since the scribes were lawyers, much of their time was occupied in teaching and judicial functions. Since the separation of the Pharisaic and Sadducean tendencies in Judaism, the scribes generally belonged to the Pharisaic class. The Pharisees recognized, and we'll go into a little bit of this, the Pharisees recognized the interpretations or traditions which the scribes in the course of time developed out of the body of the written law and enforced upon the people as binding rule of life. Since, however, scribes are merely students of the law, there were also some scribes of the Sadducee type. So that's what the scribes are. They're the lawyers. What about the Herodians? From the same reference, the Herodians are mentioned twice in the Gospels as acting with the Pharisees in opposition to Jesus. They were not a religious sect, but as the name implies, a court or a political party, supporters of the dynasty of Herod. Nothing's known of them beyond what the Gospels state. Whatever their political aims, they early perceived that Christ's pure and spiritual teaching on the kingdom of God was irreconcilable with these, and that Christ's influence with the people was antagonistic to their interests. So that's the Herodians. So a little bit of background about each one. Let's take a look at what Jesus says in verse 23. Let's turn over there. And remember, he answered all these questions, and then he turned to the crowd, and he said these things. And they were there. They were probably there listening. Verse 2, he says, the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. You know, they were the religious leaders of the day, and he recognized that. So he said in verse 3, therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not according to their works, for they say and do not. The New Living Translation says, they don't practice what they teach. A lot plainer. That's interesting because he just gave that parable. He just gave that parable. Which one did the will of the Father? Well, the one that actually did what he said he was going to do. And then he tells the crowd, they don't practice what they teach. So They heard this. Do you think they felt the sting of that? Thinking back to that parable, I wonder if they thought about that. You know, we have leaders that don't practice what they teach. Have you seen the news lately? It's the same. It's the same. Turn to Matthew 7. Hold your place here. We're going to come back. Matthew 7. I'll just read a couple of scriptures. And from the New Living Translation, it says in verse 15, Matthew 7, verse 15, it says, "Beware of false prophets who come disguised as harmless sheep, but are really vicious wolves. You can identify them by their fruit, that is, the way they act." Verse 20, jump over there. He sums it up by saying, yes, you can identify a tree by its fruit, so you can identify people by their actions. So Christ said that many times. And he says this in Matthew 23 about the scribes and the Pharisees. It's not what they say. It's what they do. They said all the right things. So back to Matthew 23. We'll pick up in verse 4 again. Because Jesus continues talking about these leaders of the day. Verse 4, "For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move one of them with their fingers." The New Living Translation translates that this way. Verse 4, "They crush people with unbearable religious demands and never lift a finger to ease the burden." You know, that's what the scribes developed, as I was talking about earlier. Things from tradition. John Gill's exposition of the Bible says this about verse 4. It says, "This does not mean the rites in the ceremonies of the law of Moses, circumcision and other rituals, but the tradition of the elders, which the scribes and Pharisees were very tenacious of and severely enjoined the observance of and are called their heavy things, which they added to the law. Now the binding of these heavy things means the imposing them on men, obliging them to observe them very strictly under great penalty should they omit them." He goes on and he says, "The sense is they were so rigid and hard-hearted that they would not move a finger to remove these burdens from the shoulders of men or to ease them in the least degree or dispense with their performance of them in the least measure upon any consideration. Though this was also true in many respects, they were so slothful themselves that though they strictly enjoined the observance of the numerous and unwritten traditions on the people, yet in many cases where they could without public notice, they neglected them themselves, or at least they made them lighter and easier for themselves." What were some of those? We've heard those. We've all laughed about them. You can't walk so far. You can't lift three or more figs. You know, those things were added. The book I mentioned earlier, The Life and Times of Jesus, says this about these added things. "Very many of them are so utterly trivial and absurd that only hair-splitting ingenuity of theologians can account for them. Others are so profane that it's difficult to understand how any religion could coexist with them. Conceive, for example, that two schools of the Pharisees were in controversy whether it was lawful to kill a louse on the Sabbath." That's amazing. That's just amazing. Trivial stuff like that. Let's go on to verse 5. And he says, "But their works they do to be seen by men." You know, you remember the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, in the sixth chapter. He specifically says, don't do that. He says, take heed to yourself that you don't do your righteousness before men to be seen of men. For verily I say, you have your reward. You've got the respect of men. You've got your reward. That's all you get. And we see in the following few verses, examples of the things they did before people. Continuing in verse 5, they make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. Now, what is he talking about here? What are these phylacteries? What are these borders? Well, they would take sections of the law, and they would roll these up, and they would put them between skins of clean animals, and later, boxes. And they would put them between, they would tie them on their forehead, and they would go between your eyes. They also tied one to their arm. And some of the commentaries say that later, they began using big boxes and tying them to their heads. Now, just for your information, the scriptures that they rolled up was Exodus 13, 2 through 11, Exodus 13, 11 through 17, Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 10, and Deuteronomy 11, verses 13 through 22. They'd roll those up, and they'd put them right in the middle of their forehead. The one for the arm was fastened between the elbow and the shoulder on the inside of the arm so that it could be close to their heart. Very interesting. Why did they do that? Well, they took two scriptures, and we don't have to turn there, but if you look in Exodus 12 or Deuteronomy 6, it says that they should bind upon their hands and as a frontlet between their eyes, the law. And they took that literally. So they actually stuck them to their forehead and put them on there. The New Living Translation makes verse 5 a little plainer. It says, everything they do is for show. On their arms, they wore extra wide prayer boxes and with scripture verses inside. And their robes with extra long tassels. John Gill says this in his commentary about verse 5. They imagined there was a great deal of holiness in and valued themselves much upon the use of them. And the Pharisees, because they would be thought to be more holy and religious and more observant of the law than others, they wore these things broader than the rest of the people. So, you know, they weren't satisfied with what everyone else had. That wasn't enough for them. They had to have big boxes. They had to have long tassels. And everyone could see them from far away. How special they were. That's what they were doing. And that's exactly what Jesus said, don't do. Don't do that to impress people. Now, it's really kind of interesting that they didn't wear these on the Sabbath day. Why didn't they wear them on the Sabbath day? Any guesses? They were too heavy. They weren't allowed to lift them. What about the fringes? You know, this comes from Numbers 15, verses 38 through to 41. And it talks about putting a fringe as a remembrance, okay? But, you know, they weren't satisfied with something that they could look at and see. That had no use for them. They wanted something really long, really impressive, that all the people could see. So they had big, giant borders with huge tassels. And that's not what Numbers talked about at all. Let's go on to verse 6. They loved the best places at the feast, the best seats in the synagogue. Greetings in the marketplace, to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. They loved the attention. They just loved that. You know, the chief seats in the temple were in the front. But they weren't just in the front facing the speaker like we would think. They were in the front facing the audience. So everyone could see how righteous they were. Everyone could see them going through their little prayers and such. They loved the upper places in the synagogue and at the feast and all. You know, they used to stroll through the marketplace, as verse 7 indicates. And when you met a rabbi, you were expected to greet them. And failure to provide an appropriate greeting was punishable, extremely punishable. And you were supposed to walk up, and as the rabbi put his hand out, you were supposed to bow, go to one knee perhaps, and say something like, "May your peace be great, my master." Something like that, or equally impressive. And like I said, if you didn't do that, that was met with harsh punishment. Can you imagine doing that today? It's interesting. So Christ goes on, because this is their custom. Can you imagine their reaction as he is talking? Imagine that. Imagine they're sitting there listening to this. And he says in verse 8, "But you, do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ. And you're all brethren. Don't call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. And don't be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ." And he says something very strange that I'm sure they didn't agree with in verse 11. "He who's the greatest among you shall be your servant." Not like these guys. They were used to being served. They weren't servants at all. Verse 12, "Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Oh, wait, that's one of the Beatitudes. I just read that. That's the opposite of what these guys are doing. The old King James Version in verse 10 says, "Do not be called masters, for one is your master, even Christ." So he's telling them, don't give them the standard greeting in the marketplace. No wonder they crucified him. Look at all the things he said about him. Don't call anybody your master. You only have one. And that leads us to verse 13. That's where the Beatitudes. That's where the woes start. So all that is information leading up. And you can tell through Matthew 21, all the way through here, what's being said was pretty condemning of the leaders of their day. You know, he acknowledges they sit in Moses' seat, but he wants this recorded, and it's recorded for us. So we're not fooled by some of the same things. And we look at this and say, oh, well, you'd never be fooled by that. Lots have. A lot of people have. Look how many people are sitting here. Where's the 350 people? Verse 13. He says, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. You shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. You know, the first woe, what does that mean, shutting up the kingdom of God against men? Well, it was the opposition, in part, that they had to him, to Christ. You know, they had a belief that righteousness and their piety was exclusive to them. The common man was ignorant. They couldn't understand these things. They didn't believe that Christ was the Messiah. They didn't believe the doctrines that he taught, the person of his office. They rejected everything that he stood for. So they shut up the kingdom. Matthew Henry's commentary says that they were sworn enemies of this verse to the gospel of Christ and consequently to the salvation of the souls of men. They shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, that is, they did all they could to keep people from believing in Christ and so entering into his kingdom. Let's go on to verse 14, the second woe. He says, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense you make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Devours widows' houses. What in the world does that mean? John Gill says this in his commentary about verse 14. The goods in the houses of such as were left with fatherless children and but little to support them, being left alone and none to advise them and being weak and prone to superstition, these greedy dogs, as Isaiah called them, who could never have enough, easily imposed upon them, wormed them out of their substance, stripped them bare of the necessities of life, prevailed on them to sell their houses and goods and bestow them on them, or got their little estates into their hands, pretending to care and dispose of them to their advantage. You know, some things never change. We still have people that want to devour your house. We have churches everywhere, some led by people that used to be with us, who tell you, or their followers, sell your investment property. The push is here. Christ is almost here. Sell everything. Send it on in. And you know, the sad part is, there are some that did. So it still works today. It still works. They still get their money. But look what it says about these people. Why don't they understand that this is a violation? It's a shame that people's life savings have been wasted like this. You know, I hope we're never fooled by those sort of things. You know, if you really want to send your money in, send it to me. Because, you know, I won't lie to you about what I'm going to do with it. It's amazing that people get fooled. But where does it say in the scriptures that you're required to sell everything and give it away? You know, it says in Matthew 24, just the opposite. It says if you're in the city, flee. It doesn't say sell everything and send it in. If you're on a housetop, stay there. Don't come down. Don't get anything. If you're in a field, run for it, it says. Don't even come back for your clothes. Just go. We have more people around that are willing to devour your house. Matthew Henry says this of this verse: the Pharisees' long prayers were made up of vain repetitions, and they were a pretense. By them, they got the reputation of being pious, devout men that loved prayer and were the favorites of heaven. And by this means, people were made to believe it was not possible that such men would cheat them. And therefore, happy was the widow who could get a Pharisee for her trustee and guardian to her children. What a shame. Shame on them. Verse 15. Another woe. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you made him twice as much the son of hell as yourself. You know, he's really taking the gloves off here. What does he mean by that? You know, you get the idea, he's not thrilled. He's probably yelling by this time. Twice as much of a son of hell, what does that mean? John Gill's commentary says, their former errors in heathenism, some of which they might still retain, they added new ones as equally as bad, and were but more and more deserving of hell, even more than their masters, the ones who got them as proselytes. They were trained up by them in the most bitter prejudices against Christ and the gospel, and many of them proved more violent persecutors of the followers of Christ than the original Jews themselves. And we see that in the book of Acts. We see how that's true. So let's go on. Verse 16 and 22 is talking about oaths. And we read some of these here, and it seems rather humorous, and it's an odd thing for us. But he says, blind guides, in verse 16, how terrible it will be for you. For you say that it means nothing to swear by God's temple. You can break that oath. But then you say it is binding to swear by the gold in the temple. And this is from the New Living Translation. I forgot to tell you that. Verse 17, blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? And you say to take an oath by the altar can be broken, but to swear by the gifts on the altar is binding. How blind? Which is greater, the gifts on the altar or the altar that makes the gifts sacred? When you swear by the altar, you're swearing by it and by everything on it. And when you swear by the temple, you're swearing by it and by God who lives in it. And when you swear by heaven, you're swearing by the throne of God and by God who sits on the throne. You know, that's all kind of odd to us. Why would you swear by anything? But, you know, it was really common in those days to make a point. You would say, well, I'm going to do this by the temple. I'm going to do this. And, you know, we don't talk like that today, but that's, why would you even do that? Why would you do that? Why can't they just make their yes, yes, and their no, no? It's so much easier. It's kind of funny to even think about it. I guess it's more dramatic. It's more dramatic to swear by something. Because you really know I'm telling you the truth now. I really mean what I'm going to say. I didn't mean it before, but I really mean it now. I really do. Really. We had a guy at work Every time he wanted to make a point, and I called him on it almost every time, he'd say, well, let me be honest with you. And I'd usually say, you weren't being honest before? What's the deal? And he, it's just a saying. Oh, okay, you want to make emphasis on something. I don't know why that's necessary, but let me be honest with you. I just don't know why it's necessary. The next woe. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, in verse 23, it's going on. For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. And in verse 24 he says, blind guides who strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. The life and times of Jesus by Edersheim again. It says, this fifth woe refers to one of the best known and strangest Jewish ordinances, which extended the law, the Mosaic law of tithing, in the most burdensome minuteness, even to the smallest product of the soil that could be preserved. Of these, according to some, not only seeds, but in certain cases, the leaves and the stalks had to be tithed. And this, together with grievous omissions of the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith, truly, this was to strain out the gnat and swallow the camel. So, like so many rules those scribes come up with, they came up with, well, I don't know, you know, this has got, what do you do with five seeds? And you can give them three, you give them two. Let's split one in half. You know, they were crazy that way. They did things like that. Oh, and straining at a gnat. I like this one. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? You know, we read that, we don't understand how it really must have upset them when he said this. Because they actually did this. When they would drink their wine, or anything for that matter, they would strain it through a cloth. They would strain it because they were not allowed to eat a gnat. It was unclean. It's an unclean creature. Not kosher. They even had a law for that. Their law states that one that eats a flea or a gnat is an apostate. They also had another law, whosoever eats a whole fly or a whole gnat, whether alive or dead, was to be beaten on account of a creeping, flying thing. Crazy stuff. Straining at the gnat. And then he says, but you're omitting the more important things. You're swallowing a camel. And a camel's unclean too. You know, some of these things, unless you look into it, they just seem funny. You know, I used to think straining at a gnat, maybe they were straining to see it. No, this is what it really means. Crazy. So he's telling him, you're putting your focus on the wrong things. You're just putting your focus on the wrong things. John Gill says this, about this verse, just as many hypocrites like them, they made a great stir and would appear very conscientious and scrupulous about some of the trifling things, and yet at other times commit the grossest enormities, the most scandalous sins in life. And that's why the next two woes talk about hypocrisy. Verse 25, he says, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. You cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisees, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside may be clean also. You know, they had very scrupulous rules about cleaning, washing. You remember they even asked Christ, why does your disciples eat without washing their hands? There was rules for that. Just like the dishes. Just like the pots. And he goes on and he says, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You're like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. You know, men seem to always look at outward appearances. You know, boy, that cemetery's pretty. Yeah. That's what he's saying here. But God looks at the heart. God looks at what's inside. And Jesus emphasizes that it's more important, our actions and attitudes are more important than an outward appearance. It's what's within you, what's within this person that really counts. One last woe to go. I'll read this from the New Living Translation. Verse 29, he says, how terrible it will be for you teachers of religious law and you Pharisees, hypocrites. You build tombs for the prophets your ancestors killed and decorate the graves of godly people that your ancestors destroyed. And in verse 30, he says, you know, when you say, we would never have joined them in killing the prophets. How many times have we said something like that? I would have never denied Christ like Peter did. Yeah, you would. You would. Don't ever say you wouldn't do anything. Because that's exactly what you'll end up doing. Peter did that. He said, I won't deny you. And then he did. And they say this here. We would have never joined and killed the prophets. But look what they did in the future of these verses. Verse 31, in saying that, you're accusing yourself of being the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. And then he talks about himself, and he talks about the future. In verse 32, he says, go ahead, finish what you started. You snakes, you sons of vipers, how will you escape the judgment of hell? And in verse 34, he says, I'll send you prophets and wise men and teachers of religious law. You'll kill some of them by crucifixion and whip others in your synagogues, chasing them from city to city. And that's exactly what they did. Exactly what they did. They killed Christ by crucifixion. Many of the apostles by crucifixion, stoning, horrible things that they did to these people. You can see a lot of them in the book of Acts. You can also see a lot of them in history. Josephus talks about a lot of that. So there are the eight woes. Matthew 23. It's very interesting history. But it also has a lesson for us today. But, you know, going through that, I just would have liked to have been that unclean fly on the wall so that I could watch their reaction. It would have been very interesting because, boy, no wonder they crucified him, right? Look how he talked about him. What's our takeaway from this? What do we learn from that? We should be following the proper attitudes in Matthew 5. Remember at the beginning I said they contrast to these attitudes, the wrong attitudes. Are we a spiritual hindrance sometimes to people? There was a woe for that. We shouldn't be doing that. Do we improperly take advantage of a situation? Pull a fast one. There's a woe for that. We shouldn't be doing that. Can you be trusted? Does your word mean anything? Do you do what you say you're going to do? You know, these are all lessons that we can learn. Are we sticklers about small details and then forget the weightier matters? Nah, we don't do that. We don't do that. But during the days of unleavened bread, do you look for that little crumb and then forget what it's all about? There's a woe for that. Let's not do that. Let's remember the lesson. The crumb, not so important, right? You know, you've heard me tell stories about how I found, in sermonettes in past, how I've found crackers in my golf bag way after the days of unleavened bread. Because I always keep a little pack of crackers in my golf bag in case I get hungry. And the first time out, I zipped open the pouch, I opened it up. Was I upset about that? It teaches you a lesson. The crumb, the cracker, is nothing. You should get rid of it, yes. But I found them, I looked at them, and I smiled and said, "You taught me something. You taught me something." And I didn't eat them. I threw them away. Way after the fact, but I learned a lesson. That's the weightier matter. Learn the lesson. Does our public image match our character? It didn't with the Pharisees, but it should with us. You know, all these lessons we can learn from this set of scriptures. And Jesus warns us not to be like that. So it's very interesting that the sermonette time, Pete was talking about walking with God. That's what we should be doing. We should be concentrating on the attitudes of Matthew 5 and learning the lesson about what Jesus says about the Pharisees and the scribes and their attitudes and their actions.